Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for tuning in. I think you may learn some things you didn't know about the great abolitionist and son of Maryland, Frederick Douglass. We're going to talk about Frederick Douglass and his passion for photography. A new book titled Picturing Frederick Douglass, an illustrated biography of the 19th century's most photographed American, published by Livewright Publishing Corporation, features 160 distinct photos of him. By contrast, scholars have found only 127 photos of Walt Whitman and 126 of Abraham Lincoln. In an era when sitting for a photograph could mean minutes of immobility, Douglass sought out every opportunity he could. He began posing soon after he escaped slavery in 1838 and continued until his death in 1895, and he wrote extensively on photography and picture making. What made a former slave who devoted his life to seeking emancipation for the oppressed embrace this new medium? To help us answer this question, John Stauffer, professor of English, American Studies, and African American Studies at Harvard University, joins us by phone. He's one of the authors of Picturing Frederick Douglass, along with Zoe Trod and Celeste Marie Bernier. John Stauffer, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be on the air with you.
And I'm very glad you could join us. And from the NPR studios in Washington, Kenneth Morris Jr. joins us. He is Frederick Douglass's great-great-great-grandson, and he wrote the afterword to the book. Do I have that right, Ken Morris, great-great-great-grandson?
You have that absolutely right. I know it's a lot of greats.
It's a lot of greats, and it's very great. I'm very pleased for the chance to talk to you about it. But John, let me start with you. How did you first learn about Frederick Douglass's passion for photography?
When I was in graduate school at Yale, Douglass was one of the four main figures in my first book, and I was struck by how frequently I came across new photographs of him. And so I started collecting different poses of Frederick Douglass, and it grew to enough of a passion that Zoe, who I've known for a long time, and Celeste and I decided to team up and to just systematically exhaust the archives and find out how many separate photographs there were of Douglass, and to put all in one book the work that we were familiar with about why Douglass was in love with photography and why he saw it as a crucial aid in ending slavery and racism and achieving civil rights.
Let me pick up on that point, although I'm sure we'll get back to it. Why did go straight to why he saw this as a crucial tool of democracy?
For three reasons. One is he believed in the democratic nature of photography, and he associated the democratic nature of photography with freedom, as he understood and knew that America had a love affair with photography that surpassed that of every other country. It was limited chiefly to the free states. There was a comparative dearth of photographs circulating in the slave states for a variety of reasons: censorship, lack of roads, lack of a capitalist infrastructure. And Douglass understood that with the invention of photography, for the first time ever, the poorest servant girl or a slave could have a portrait of herself that surpassed in accuracy and beauty and detail that of the most powerful king 10 years earlier. And so that's one answer, is the way in which, for the first time, people could get these beautiful, accurate portraits, representations of themselves, and 95% of all the photographs were portraits in the first five decades. The second reason is that Douglass recognized that photography offered a truth value, and as an abolitionist, he understood that truthful reporting, truthful image was the most powerful weapon against slavery and racism, because the truth of slavery, the truth of racism, exposed the attempt to dehumanize other human beings. In other words, the truthful nature of photography captured the essential humanity of all people, and that was central. And Douglass, like most other, virtually every other American, believed in the truth value of the camera, even though photographers themselves recognized that they could distort the image. The faith in its truthfulness was crucial. And the third reason is that Douglas really borrowed from Aristotle and Emerson and Carlyle and this long tradition of philosophy, and saying that the love of photography among African Americans, among Americans, among people in general, highlights the equal humanity of all people. In other words, only humans, he said, have the desire for portraits. Only humans have the desire to represent themselves in the world. No other animal can even recognize itself in a mirror. And the fact that humans desire this picture-making process is what he termed it, highlights the degree that we're all essentially equal as humans. And he thus just overturned this large field of what was known as ethnology among scientists, who were trying to argue based on cranium size and other factors that people of African descent were somehow subhuman or innately different than human, than other people, and Douglas just dismissed them out of hand by drawing on the photograph.
Professor John Stauffer, you have just given us a whole lot to think about. And as I said, we will get back to us. John Stauffer is one of the authors of Picturing Frederick Douglass, a new pictorial biography of Frederick Douglass, here on Midday on WYPR. And also with us is Ken Morris Jr., Frederick Douglass's great-great-great-grandson. Were you aware before this book that your great-great-great-grandfather was so passionate about photography?
No, I wasn't. I was aware that there were a number of photographs of him, certainly growing up. His image was everywhere. And I first heard about the project a few years ago, and there was a headline that I read that said Frederick Douglass was the most photographed American of the 19th century. And I was very shocked by that, but also very proud. And it wasn't until Professor Zoe Trod approached me. We were at a conference together at Yale University in 2012.
And she is one of the co-authors of this book.
Absolutely. And she had all of the photographs and was very excited to share those with me. And we started thumbing through them. And there were many photographs in there that I had never seen before.
Well, but you did sort of grow up with many photographs of your ancestor, right? You spent summers in a house in Highland Beach, Maryland, in Anne Arundel County, and that was built for Frederick Douglass. And in the afterword you wrote, you describe encountering a photograph of, quote, the man with the big white hair when you were about 5 years old. Tell us about that.
I spent all of my summers in the home that was built for Frederick Douglass to retire in, and it was built by my great-great-grandfather Charles, who was Frederick's youngest son, and the home was built on the Chesapeake Bay in a strategic spot so that Frederick could sit at the top of the house in a place that he called the tower and look back across the water, and on the other side you could see land, and that land is the eastern shore of Maryland, where he was born into slavery and toiled away in chains. And in that house, I remember being about 5 years old, and at the top of the stairs, there was this larger-than-life portrait of the man that we called the man with the great big white hair. In fact, my great-grandmother, who lived to be 103 years old, she was married to Frederick Douglass's grandson, Joseph, who's my great-grandfather. And when she was 8 years old, she actually met Frederick Douglass. And she called him the man with the great big white hair until the day she died. But this portrait was at the top of the stairs. And being a little boy with this great imagination, I would look at that. And the first thing that I would think was, man, you look mean.
Okay.
And, you know, he always had this very stern look on his face. And I knew that he was my ancestor. But I remember thinking, you look mean and I'm glad I didn't know you. And as I would try and sneak past the portrait, his eyes would follow me. And by the time I would get down to the end of the hallway, I always imagined this booming baritone voice bellowing down upon my tiny person. And he would say, you will do great things, young man. So,
oh, wow.
Yes, his images have always moved me.
Professor Stauffer, let me pick up on that point with you. Ken Morris is right that almost all of these photos of Frederick Douglass have a very stern expression. Yeah. Even the first ones, very soon after he escaped slavery at the age of 20, he's a very solemn person all the way through.
Yeah.
Was that the mode in 19th century, or was he in particular trying to send a message?
He was trying to send a message. And the message he was trying to send is he wanted to overturn the racist caricature of the happy slave or servant. And that was widespread in not photographic base, but in other print media and drawings and of the slave or the black with a smile, a kind of grotesque caricatured smile. And also Douglass, from the time he was first photographed until the end of the Civil War, I mean, he was legally a slave for a number of years, until 1847. So the first photographs, he's legally a slave, and then
even though he had escaped,
he escaped from slavery in 38, in September 3rd, 1838, but he's a fugitive. So legally, he's still a slave. And then when after his success of his first autobiography in 1845, in which he names his masters, and his masters now knew where he was, and so he went to England for safety because they could capture him. He's a fugitive from justice by the law. And he had such success in England, Ireland, and Scotland that his sympathizers purchased his freedom, essentially wrote to his masters, Hugh and Thomas Auld, and said, Douglass is here, we'll give you a discounted price for him. And so when Douglass returned to the United States in 1847, he was legally free, but slavery was expanding. And so here's a fugitive from justice and a free black in which slavery is expanding. And he's a politician and an activist. And all of his images are designed to send a message, to influence people, to have an emotional impact. A smile is not appropriate with his message of abolitionism, with his outrage at the growth of racism and the spread of slavery. And so that's another reason. And then after the Civil War, as an elder statesman, he's still fighting against the efforts of white Southerners and some white Northerners to essentially overturn the Reconstruction Amendments that guarantee freedom and citizenship and equality before the law and suffrage for half of the former slave population. And so for all those reasons, in terms of where he was in the United States, a smile was not appropriate. Plus, by smiling, it could play into the racist caricature. And not until the very end of his life. In fact, there's one of the plates that we feature of Douglass in 1894, a year before he dies, a photograph by an interracial photography team of Phineas Headley and James Reed, photographed Douglass with a relatively broad smile. Those lips are closed.
We are going to talk more about that particular photo and lots more when we come back. We need to take a short break. We'll hear more from John Stauffer, a Harvard professor who has co-written a book on the role photography played in the life of Frederick Douglass, and Kenneth Morris Jr., a descendant of Frederick Douglass, who wrote an afterword. And we hope that you will join the conversation. Do you think there's a connection between photography and freedom in the modern world? Join our conversation by calling us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cass. Today we're speaking by phone with John Stauffer, co-author of Picturing Frederick Douglass, a book about the role photography played in Frederick Douglass's life and in his mission. And Frederick Douglass's great-great-great-grandson, Kenneth Morris Jr., has joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. And you can be part of this conversation. 410-662-8780 is our local number. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We were talking before the break about that one smiling photograph taken very late in Frederick Douglass's life. And Ken Morris Jr., would you tell us what the reaction was to your family? Because as I understand it, you did not see that photograph until this book was being prepared.
Right. I was, my mom, Nettie Washington Douglass, was with me at Yale University when Zoe showed us that photograph, and I think that was the one that she was most excited to show us. And when my mom saw it for the first time, she had tears that just welled up in her eyes, and she said, you know, God bless him. He had been through so much. And to finally see him smile, to her, to my mom, that was incredibly heartwarming for her. And she, you know, grew up with these images around her as well. And she saw what the pressure of being a descendant of one of this country's greatest heroes did to her father, who was the namesake of Frederick Douglass. And it was a lot of pressure for her father to carry around. My mom's dad took his own life when my grandmother was 3 months pregnant with my mom. So my mom was born without a father, and she was raised without a father. So she was always connected to Frederick Douglass in a way that she, you know, felt for him, that he was a little boy that had been separated from his family. He had only seen his mother a few times his whole life and didn't know who his father was. It was presumed that his father was his master. He had been separated from his brothers and sisters. So, you know, it was a boy with no home, no country, and no family. And for my mom to see that photograph for the first time, she just felt just so happy and just this warmth that just spread over her. And I really wished that her father, my grandfather, could have also lived to see Frederick smile.
Professor Stauffer, would you remind us where photography was in its development when Frederick Douglass started to make use of it?
Frederick Douglass, in a sense, grew up with photography. He first became a public speaker for the American Anti-Slavery Society in 1841. Photography was invented in 1839.
Wow.
But it really took 2 years before the exposure times could get reduced to a degree where it would accommodate portraits. So Douglass's first known photograph is in 1841, at the very moment in which exposure times had now been reduced to a few minutes, which is still very long, but at least you could have portraits. So it was another reason why he was in love with photography, essentially this medium, this new technology that he saw as being so beneficial to his cause, grows up at the same time his own public persona is developing.
And he was, the impression that I am left with from your book, Picturing Frederick Douglass, is that he was very deliberately developing a brand.
Yes, he was developing a brand. He was. He saw the relationship between himself and the photographer and the camera as what I call a pas de trois, a dance for three. He choreographed. He participated in choreographing a look, and the brand, his brand, his signature, his visual signature, so to speak, evolved as he himself evolved, and in the. From the 1840s and 1850s, it was as a steely revolutionary. I mean, here is the slavery is spreading. Federal government is nationalizing slavery. This outrages him, and he's willing to whether it's becoming a free man, that's illegal, and to take up arms and to align himself with militants like John Brown. He's a steely visionary, and that's his look. So the look is to stare defiantly right into the camera lens, in other words, at the viewer, with a defiant pose in a number of the early photographs. His fists are clenched as though he's standing off ready to fight them. And that look of what one convert to the cause called majestic defiance or wrathful defiance. She said, Frederick Douglass looks majestic in his wrath. I think a wonderful phrase that captures that early signature look, both wrathful and yet majestic, dignified, demanding citizenship and making a case that he is as worthy, and blacks are as worthy of citizenship as much as anyone else, at a time in which many people, in fact, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Roger Taney, said that blacks could never be citizens. And so then his signature look changed after the war as he becomes an elder statesman. He was the first African-American to receive a federal appointment that requires Senate approval when he's marshal for the District of Columbia. He's then recorder of deeds, and he's the first black ambassador when he becomes the minister of Haiti. And so then his look becomes that of the elder statesman, the dignified elder statesman.
160 photographs reproduced in picturing Frederick Douglass. Where did you find them?
All over. So the largest single body was the Frederick Douglass site in Anacostia, Cedar Hill, which is part of the National Park Service.
Anacostia in Washington, D.C.
Yes, yes. And that's just a magnificent public park. It's part of the National Park Service. And so there are some 70 from just that huge archive. But literally, we exhausted every archive in the country. We scoured England, Ireland, and Scotland, in fact, in France and Europe. And so there are photographs from tiny little archives, from major archives like the Beinecke at Yale, like the National Park Service, like Library of Congress, and some of the most beautiful or powerful, like the one of Frederick Douglass smiling. It's at the New Bedford Whaling Museum, not a place necessarily known for archiving photographs. There's a beautiful carte de visite or 1860s photograph of that serves as the frontispiece of Douglass. He's sitting down and he looks truly magisterial and defiant. Which is it's one of my favorites. I have many favorites. That's at a very small little archive. A friend of mine, Greg French, who is a private collector, is one of the largest private collectors of African-American photographs, especially in the 19th century. He owns the stunning earliest photograph of Douglass, this daguerreotype from 1841. So it's truly from all over, and that was part of the hard work and also the pleasure of discovery.
And am I right that you have found more since you've published?
Yes, we have. We found 7 more and counting. And it was something that we had hoped for, and we're thrilled that now that people are aware of Douglass's love of photography and the fact that he's the most photographed American in the 19th century, we've had people or archives contact us and say, we think this is a new photograph. In fact, one of the most wonderful for me is that there, Douglass had 5 children, and until a couple months ago, his youngest daughter, Annie, who dies young, she's not even a teenager when she dies in 1860, there was no known photograph of Annie. And so if you go to Douglass's home in Cedar Hill, there's a wall with photographs of his family, and Annie is blank. We found in a small archive in Baton Rouge Douglass with Annie from 1853. That's just a beautiful photograph.
That's exciting.
And so we will be able to publish that in the paperback edition of the book.
That is Harvard professor John Stauffer with us by phone. We're talking about the book of which he's one of the authors, Picturing Frederick Douglass, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us from NPR in Washington is Kenneth Morris Jr., great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass. And I realize, listeners, it may be frustrating. By the way, you can be part of this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Not trying to frustrate you by talking so much about images which you don't have. They are stunning images. And one thing that occurred to me is there was an essay in New Republic which includes several of the images of the book. So we can link to that. We will link to that on our page, the Midday page at WYPR.org, so you can see some of what we're talking about. But I do want to ask Ken Morris Jr. about some of your insights about the early pictures. You write in particular about the curious poise in the first photo, the earliest photo of your great-great-great-grandfather.
I find it remarkable that this fugitive slave, who was only 3 years removed from slavery when his first photograph was taken, would understand that this new technology or this emerging medium of photography would help him make his arguments for liberation and equality in the same way that his writings and his speeches would. And when you think about the courage that it took for him to start to speak out against slavery, and John mentioned his first autobiography, which was published in 1845, that biography, by the way, became a bestseller, and it made him an instant celebrity, and that's really the last thing that you want as a fugitive slave, is the notoriety of a best-selling book. So I've always been very proud of him because of everything that he did, everything that he contributed to the country and to the world, but also to our family. So this first photograph, he is sitting there, as I said, with a curious pose, but I see within the depths of his eyes the courage that it took for this young man to stand up to his overseer at the age of 16 years old and to start to speak out against the inhumanity of slavery and the brutality that he suffered in slavery. So I love that first photograph. And then the other thing that I wrote about that picture that I love is that he's got a perfectly shaped afro, which would have made my 70s self very proud.
But then you write, Ken Morris, about another of the early photos, I think from 1848, which I just took to be pensive. And you write that you see he's showing the trauma that he carried still about a decade after having escaped slavery. You see in his expression trauma of slavery.
I do, and we've been talking about all of the photographs where he's looking directly into the camera with this very serious, stern look. And in the photograph that you're talking about, he's looking away from the camera, and he's looking down. And he looks beautiful in that photograph. He's dressed to perfection. Again, his hair is just stylish. And so I was thinking about that, and reading through the manuscript of the book, there was a letter that he had written, that Frederick had written to a fugitive slave. And in that letter, he made a comment that, "I felt so ugly today that I hated looking at myself in the glass." And it was at that moment that it just hit me that this young man had spent the first 20 years of his life in slavery. And anybody that knows his story or has read his autobiographies knows the brutality that he went through and the whippings and the scars on his back. And I had never stopped to think about the trauma that he would carry out of slavery. Now, of course, when 4 million enslaved Americans were freed, there wasn't a plan for emancipation. There wasn't counseling. There wasn't post-traumatic stress disorder. So this young man had to deal with that trauma on his own. And in that photograph, I see that trauma and just that pain. And when I read that comment that he made about feeling so ugly, it really did bring tears to my eyes, because I just always thought of him as just this strong freedom fighter and abolitionist. And it really humanized him in a lot of way, that photograph.
Professor Stauffer, was counteracting racist images of black people part of his goal in orchestrating this series of fairly somber images of himself?
Yeah, that is, as I said, that was one of his major goals. And coupled with that was the goal of presenting himself to the public, much as he did as an orator. He was widely considered, if not the greatest orator, but one of the greatest orators or public speakers at a time in which public speaking was as important as professional athletics or being a movie star today. It was one of the few forms of entertainment. And but not only at countering racist imagery, but making a case demanding that he have as much right to citizenship. In a sense, these portraits suggest that it was out-citizening white citizens, saying, my appearance is such that I deserve to be allowed to enter any place in the country as much as any white. And he was the first African American to meet with and advise a U.S. president when he met with Lincoln, and between his public speaking, his writing, his look, the visual image that he sent forth into the world, he was also not just countering racist imagery, but demanding complete equality.
Henry Louis Gates, Jr., in his commentary that you've included in the book, raises the question, and you referred to a minute ago that it was that Douglas did not know for sure who his father was. It was assumed it was his master, who was white. Although Douglas at one point said mostly white in one of his autobiographies.
Was
this question of proving that Douglas didn't get his genius from some small connection to being white, was that tremendously important?
Yes, because part of the racist, part of the racism that was so prevalent in the United States in the 19th century was to argue that if mulatto was eloquent and a good writer, it came from his white blood or her white blood. And so in his second autobiography, Douglas specifically counters that by saying, most of whatever intelligence I have, whatever gifts or talents I have as a writer and a speaker, come from my mother. They don't come from my father.
Very interesting. We need to take another short break here. When we come back, a lot more to talk about with John Stauffer, co-writer of Picturing Frederick Douglass, a book about the famous abolitionist and his deep interest in philosophy, and with Kenneth Morse, Jr., a Douglass descendant, who wrote an afterword. What are your questions about this book? Do you have questions about what it's like to carry the legacy of an icon like Frederick Douglass? Do you have some thoughts about whether Frederick Douglass was doing with these photographs what people do today on Facebook? Give us a call. 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be right back.
You're tuned to Midday on WYPR, your NPR news station. Good afternoon, Matt Taka for Nathan today. Support comes from our members, thank you, and from the Y in Central Maryland, focused on preventing the achievement gap caused by economic disparity. With donations...
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Frederick Douglass was the most photographed American of the 19th century. So I'm speaking with John Stauffer, who has co-written a book about Douglass's love of photography, and Kenneth Morse, Jr., Frederick Douglass's great-great-great-grandson, who grew up surrounded by some of these photographs. Do you think any of our new technologies have the same political power the photograph did for Frederick Douglass? Join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Professor Stauffer, you wrote in the book, or one of you wrote, quote, we see a war waged over Douglass's visual persona, close quote. Tell us about that war. Who was waging it?
Waging it, the racist whites on the one hand were waging a war in how blacks were represented, and they tried to represent blacks in a way that suggested they should not deserve equality before the law. They should not deserve the same kind of freedom that whites had. And on the other side are Frederick Douglass and his army, who were waging a war for representing blacks as fully equal, as dignified, as worthy of the fundamental, the inalienable rights of equality and of freedom as anyone else. And that in the capsule is the war.
And so the images on the other side were what? I mean, Douglass was in charge of the photographs for which he himself posed.
Right. So we have several, and there's a section in the book on the non-photographic images. Think of the blackface minstrelsy prints that were proliferated, or the black with big red lips, smiling face from ear to ear, big eyes, just these gross caricatures that, most Americans are still familiar with them. Not that many years ago, cream of wheat cereal had a caricature of an African American on it. It was just, they were ubiquitous, and they were widespread. They were rampant beginning in the 1840s. And so for Douglass to present himself with the dignity and the severity and the class that he did was a powerful antidote to all these racist caricatures. And he was very sensitive and understood that the cultural power of a photograph meant that it had to be circulated, it had to be disseminated. And his portraits were. They were on the cover of Harper's Weekly at a time in which Harper's Weekly was like Life magazine or Time magazine in its heyday, meaning everybody saw it. And
that's what I wanted to ask you, was what could he do about distributing these impressive photographs? You just mentioned one way.
Common way was through the illustrated press, in which it was the age before the halftone. So when we pick up the New York Times or Washington Post today, a photograph on the front page or anywhere, and it's technically a halftone, which is a very accurate rendition of the underlying photograph. In Douglass's day, the halftone process was not invented, and so the illustrated press hired armies of very competent engravers to cut an engraving from the photograph. And if you see the engraving next to the photograph, they're almost identical. And although it's an engraving and not a photograph, the illustrated press ignored that transfer process. And Harper's, it would just say, photograph by, Gardner, photograph by whoever it was. And Americans, like the British also had the Illustrated London News, understood these engravings cut from photographs as having the same degree of truth value of accuracy as the photographs themselves. He also distributed them through the anti-slavery and abolitionist circuit before the Civil War, so as for a subscription to his newspaper, you could receive a photograph. At abolition fairs, there were Douglass photographs for sale. They were ways to rally the larger cause of black freedom and equality.
Hmm. We have a call from Tony in Towson. Tony, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you. This is a little off the subject of photography, but since Mr. Morris is a distant relative and knew some of the older relatives, I read an article in the Smithsonian in 1987 or 88 in which it stated that Mr. Douglass never taught his wife to read or write, and that she had been mostly treated as a servant in her home rather than as his wife when he entertained. And I wondered, could that be true? Did he know anything or hear anything of that?
Thank you for the call, Tony. Ken Morris?
You're talking about my great-great-great-grandmother, Anna, who we're also equally as proud of her contributions and the fact that they were married 44 years. And I always like to say that if it wasn't for Anna, who was a free black woman in Baltimore, planting the seed in Frederick's mind that you are not meant to be a slave, and that if we're to get married and have children, I don't want our children's father to be a slave. She would assist him by selling a feather bed to raise money for his escape, help him with the disguise that he would use to escape. So everything that our family that has been passed down through the generations about Anna, she was a strong woman. She took care of the money. When he was out on the road, he would send the money home, and he would be surprised when he would come back, and there would be more money than what he had sent home. So, yes, she did not know how to read and write, and history tells us that she didn't have much of an interest in that. But I am very proud of her and their relationship and her contributions to being the person that was right there with him as he was doing this important work.
And is it your impression, what does the family know about the extent to which Frederick Douglass credited her?
Well, he credited her. Well, he didn't talk much in public about the family at all. In fact, when John was talking about this new photograph with Annie, who was their youngest daughter, that would be the first known photograph where he's pictured with one of his own children. So he was a private man when it came to his family, and so much of Frederick Douglass belongs to the country and to the world, and there are many things in our family that have been passed down that are not public, and we choose to keep those things to ourselves.
It was also the tradition at the time for public figures, particularly public men, when they would write memoirs, autobiographies, they rarely talked about their family or their spouses. So what Douglass's comparative silence about Anna was representative of most public men at that time.
I do want listeners to understand, Ken Morris, that you are descended from not one but two iconic figures, Frederick Douglass and also Booker T. Washington, the former slave and great educator. Can you briefly tell us how your families came together?
That's the first question that people always want to know when they meet me for the first time. They'll say, well, wait a minute, Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington were not related to each other, so how is it possible you're related to both of them? That happened on my mom's side of the family. My grandfather, my mom's father, was Frederick Douglass III, and he was Frederick Douglass's great-grandson. And my grandmother, Nettie Hancock Washington, was Booker T. Washington's granddaughter. My grandparents met in 1941 at Tuskegee Institute, which is a school that Booker T. Washington founded in 1881. They happened to be on campus the same day. They were rushing across to get to the other side, literally bumped into each other, didn't know that the other descended from an historic family. They fell in love at first sight and wound up getting married 3 months later. So when my mom, Nettie Washington Douglass, was born, she was the first person to unite the bloodlines of those historic families.
What a story. I want to read an email and then tie it in with a caller who's calling us. Anne writes us, I have just finished reading John Stauffer's Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. And I maintain the little park here in St. Michael's, Maryland, dedicated to Douglass. And Anne asks, are there photos of Douglass with Lincoln? But then, Dave from Baltimore, you also have a question about whether there's another set of photos. Dave, welcome to the show.
Yes, if he's in any photos with John Brown or in a group kind of setting, Union soldiers or something like that.
Dave, thanks. Thanks for that question. Professor Stauffer?
Great questions. So the Alexander Gardner's famous photograph of Lincoln's second inaugural shows Lincoln delivering his speech and Douglass in the crowd, essentially having a front row seat. And so Douglass is, in fact, it's in the book, that you see Douglass very close to Lincoln speaking. And Douglass attends the ceremony at the White House afterward. He had been invited to it. And when Lincoln sees him entering, he raises his long arm and he says, here comes my friend Frederick Douglass. I saw you in the crowd today What did you think of my address? There is no man in these United States whose opinion I value more than yours. And Douglas responded, Mr. Lincoln, that was a sacred effort. So it's a wonderful photograph that kind of captures that moment. Douglas was a close friend of John Brown. There are no known photographs of Douglas with John Brown, unfortunately. There are some of Douglas with other leading abolitionists, particularly a Cazenovian New York anti-fugitive slave law convention with some fugitives, and Garrett Smith, who was one of the most prominent white abolitionists, also a close friend of John Brown. Garrett Smith is in mid-speech, and Frederick Douglass has just finished a speech and is sitting right in front of him. But at this time, because of the still comparatively crude technology, even in the 1850s, the exposure time was several seconds. So in order to capture someone like Douglas or John Brown mid-speech, that's a huge accomplishment. So we have in our book a photograph of Douglas actually in mid-speech at Tuskegee. We think sitting to the side of him is the young Booker T. Washington. But for Douglas to be mid-speech when photography is still, compared to today, and
it's a hard thing.
Infancy. Yeah, that's a hard thing to do.
We have just a couple minutes left, and I need to ask Ken Morris this. You call yourself an abolitionist. Tell us what you mean by that.
I'm president of our family organization, the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives, and we use the legacies of both of my ancestors, Frederick Douglass being the great abolitionist, Booker T. Washington, the great educator. And we talk about abolition through education, and our organization provides human trafficking and sex trafficking prevention education for secondary schools. And so slavery still exists today. It exists in every civilized and uncivilized country around the world, including right here in the United States. So the families of Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington are continuing the fight for freedom today.
You, when you write about this in this book, you seem, I won't say amazed, but struck by how you have come to this issue as if it were in your DNA.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I never really embraced this lineage, and there were many reasons for that. I talked about my grandfather and what the pressure did to him. And when I was younger, the few times I would tell people of my relationship, nobody ever believed me. And I never thought that it was a point worth arguing. So I was happy to be a family man. I have two daughters, 20 and 17 now. And I was just rolling along. And a good friend of mine, Robert Benz, who's also co-founder of the organization, handed me a National Geographic magazine. And the cover story was 21st Century Slaves. And when I read that story,
that brought you right to where you are.
Lineages.
We will link to your website from our website so that listeners can know more about that. And as I mentioned, we'll also link to a New Republic essay that includes some of these fabulous photographs. But I must say, if somebody really wants to catch up with the evolution of Frederick Douglass, this book, Picturing Frederick Douglass, is quite an addition. I want to thank you both for talking to us about it. John Stauffer, Harvard Professor of English American Studies and African American Studies. The book he co-wrote is titled Picturing Frederick Douglass, an Illustrated Biography of the 19th Century's Most Photographed American. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
And Kenneth Morris Jr., Frederick Douglass's great-great-great-grandson. Thanks also to Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guests. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features sandwiches and salads with specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. Hope you'll be back with us tomorrow. A $25,000 reward is being offered to solve the mysterious deaths of 13 bald eagles on the Eastern Shore. We're going to talk about the status of our national bird. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.